This is Class War Battlefield Podcast. When I began this podcast back in 2011, I couldn't imagine I'd still be producing it 12 years later. When I began, I sought to add content in context to conversations that often lacked certain perspectives. Today, I am proud to say I have not only done that, but I continue to do that. During my time on the air, many better podcasts have come and gone. And they have come and gone because they didn't have the support that they needed to survive. Today, we need great podcasts, great news sources, but most importantly, we need greater information. So, using your hard-earned dollars, support the projects that give you that information. Oftentimes, those projects are local or regional. They're not that big, and they never will be. Support the things that add true value to your life. I am your host, Vymir Disogaya. I hope you enjoy the show.
And now,
the definition. Definition.
So I'm now joined by Donald Cohen. He's the founder and executive director of the Research Center in the Public Interest, and of course, co-author with Alan McCallion of the book, The Privatization of Everything, which I'll be talking to him about today. Donald, great to have you on.
Great to be here. Thanks. Thanks for having me.
Of course. So I just want to start with, well, not really privatization, but actually its opposite, which is, I think, very important to understanding the problem of privatization. And that's, of course, the concept of public goods. Now, we talk about public goods a lot on Jacobin. I think, you know, lots of progressives are sort of similarly interested in this idea of the public good and of public goods. And but I don't think that we often, you know, zero in on exactly what we mean. We kind of have like a vague conception of what that refers to. So you and Alan McCallion use a very specific definition in your book, The Privatization of Everything. And I think it's really important to start with that to kind of help shed light on the problem of privatization. So just very simply to begin, how do you define public goods and by extension, the common good?
And our definition is in contrast or maybe even in conflict with sort of the economics textbook's definition. So I define public goods in a pretty simple way. First, and three things. One is these are the things that we all need to get through life, to get through the day, health, a clean air, education, the ability to move around, mobility and transportation. Access to the internet. They're the basics. We need them. That's number one. Number two, it's also in the things that we need everyone to have, right? It's in all of our interests for every child to be educated, for every person in America to have clean water, whether we do or not, whether it's a problem for us or not. We need. It's in our economic interest. It's in our political interest. It's in our social interest for everyone to have those things. And then finally, they're the things that if we believe that they are that everyone needs them equally, that all means all, then we can only do it with public and government involvement. It doesn't mean the private sector doesn't have a role at some place and somewhere, but it only can be done by government, fundamentally. You can get everybody health care only if there's government involvement. You can get a letter to every corner of the country at the same cost only if you have the public in charge. So what's different, what's different from the economics textbook's definition says, you know, what's important to understand about that, because it's really common, understanding, they say it's either a thing that's either non-rivalrous or non-excludable. And the example I would give is a streetlight. You know, someone's using a streetlight to read a map. You can't exclude somebody else from using the streetlight for the same thing. And in fact, it's non-rivalrous. That's, you know, someone doesn't use up the streetlight. Other people can use. In that definition, without going too deep, healthcare is a private good because, yes, it's excludable. We do. And yes, it's rivalrous. I mean, in the end, everything has limits. So in the end, what that definition of public goods implies is that the market's in charge, mm-hmm. unless there's, you know, there's some failure of the market. And that's a problem.
Right. Yeah, so let's turn now to the kind of inner workings of privatization, I guess, because I suspect most people who are watching this show are pretty well aware of many of the various pitfalls of privatization, and specifically to go off of what you just said, the fact that when you put things on the market, that makes them off limits or inaccessible to many people, when many of those things like healthcare, water, so on, should be fundamental rights, right? And then, of course, you know, there's something unsavory about, obviously, businesses making a profit off of these things that should be guaranteed rights. Now, I think that's something that's really interesting about your book as well, is you argue, in addition to those problems, privatization is kind of this deliberate political strategy that is actually designed to sort of shift power away from the citizenry and toward business interests. Can you say a little bit more about that and maybe give some examples from your book? Because you have a lot of very interesting case studies.
Yeah, well, the strategic impulse of privatization really came out of the late 1980s. So I'll try to do this briefly, because many people think Reagan was the great privatizer who unleashed privatization in the country, and that's actually not true. He pretty much failed to privatize much. I mean, you know, the Democrats were still in control of Congress, and perhaps more important is people still, you know, the New Deal ethic was still alive, mm-hmm. and people still wanted the stuff. You know, they want the services. So what came from that was a strategic insights by conservatives, folks at Heritage and Cato, I mean, Heritage and other places like that, that said, well, we can use privatization to shift the demand for those public things, those public services, from the public to the private. And that would be a beginning way to sort of, you know, break the pro-big government, you know, pro-budget consensus. It would also help to organize those interests that want a piece of the pie, right? Mm-hmm. Major corporations. So there was a huge, you know, there was a coalition created of large companies around the country who began to see the opportunities of trillions of dollars in, you know, in revenues. So it was a strategic insight that really is, I think, I'm glad you raised it because it's really important for us to understand. This is about the dismantling of public services. Mm-hmm. This is really what they want to do. And, of course, shifting it to, you know, to be a cash cow for, mm-hmm. you know, for huge, for, you know, for those that are, you know, businesses that are trying to make money. So I'm going to give a couple of examples. So at the core of it, I also think it's an assault on democracy. Mm-hmm. That's kind of what I have come to believe. And I'll give, you know, one example that I've mentioned many times. It's in the book, the privatization of Chicago parking meters. I'll do the quick version. 2008, city, you know, the worst of the recession, cities bleeding red ink, really desperate times for local and state governments, seriously. And, you know, just unable to meet their budgets. The mayor announced a proposal by a consortium of three companies, global corporations, Morgan Stanley, a sovereign wealth fund from the Middle East, and a national parking company, LAZ Parking. They offered the city $1.1 billion upfront in cash in exchange for control of the city's 36,000 parking meters for 75 years. Take the deal or leave the deal. They voted 4 days later. 4 or 5 days later, and took the deal. What became true after the fact, and this is what's, you know, this is till 2083. Mm-hmm. Incredibly stupid to borrow on that future revenue, because we don't know if we'll be driving in 20, you know, by that time. Mm-hmm. But now, in the details of this contract, you know, it's a long-term lease fundamentally, if the city wants to eliminate parking spots, either, you know, temporarily for a street fair, or more significantly, permanently for, you know, dedicated bus lanes or bike lanes or you know, pedestrian malls to change land use and housing patterns, they have to purchase the spots back.
Yeah.
So essentially what that means is that if the city council and the mayor, the people who are elected to run the city of Chicago, want to, you know, do their job, you know, what's the job of a city? Land use, housing, environment, transportation, sort of real fundamentals. They have to consider how much it's going to cost them to make the private contractors whole. Mm-hmm. And that essentially ties their hands. Mm-hmm. Now, that's a terrible deal, and everybody kind of recognizes it, but the features of that deal are very common. The private sector going to, you know, the private companies are going to do a long-term or medium-term or short-term or long-term contract. They're going to have features in there that keep their interests protected and profitable, and they all do.
Right.
Privatisation has clearly failed, and the clearest evidence of that is how all around Australia now governments are getting involved in direct public investment. The clearest example of that is the Daniel Andrews government that's resuscitated the old State Electricity Corporation so that the government can invest directly in the renewable energy that the state needs. But it's not just the Victorian government that's gone down this path. Queensland, despite having tried and failed, never managed to privatise its electricity companies, and it's spending tens of billions of dollars doing the same thing, directly investing in renewable energy. But it's not just Labor state governments that are doing this. Of course, the Malcolm Turnbull coalition government spent billions of dollars on the Snowy 2.0, and the National Party is still very proud of the Inland Rail line, again, direct public investment. So there's a big pivot away from privatisation in Australia these days, which is great, and a return to simple, sensible policies like directly spending money on the things that you know the community needs. But the benefits are far greater than just the new investment in renewables or rail or Snowy. When you invest directly in these things, it's far easier to ensure that skills and training and gender pay gaps are all more directly addressed than after you privatise these things and just hoping that the new private owners will care as much about the community and the workforce as they do about the bottom line. So for decades we've been told privatisation, outsourcing, deregulation are the only answer. It's clearly not the case. Increasingly we're seeing state governments, federal governments, Labor governments, Liberal governments doing the simple and easy thing, which is to invest directly in the services and the infrastructure that our communities, our environment, and our economy needs.
Privatization, 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 privatization. It's all you hear from Republicans. But what does it actually mean? Generations ago, America built an entire national highway system, along with the largest and best public colleges and universities in the world. Also public schools and national parks. Majestic bridges, dams that generated electricity for entire regions, public libraries, public research. But around 1980, the moneyed interests began pushing to privatize much of this, giving it over to for-profit corporations. Privatization, the argument went, would boost efficiency and reduce taxes. The reality has been that privatization too often only boosts corporate bottom lines. For example, consider Trump's proposal for infrastructure. The problem is that it depends on private developers who'd make money off of both tax subsidies and private tolls. So the public would get charged twice without any guarantee that the resulting roads, bridges, or rapid transportation systems would be built where they're most needed. Now, it's true that private for-profit corporations can do certain tasks very efficiently, and some privatization has worked. But the goal of corporations is to maximize profits for shareholders, not to serve the public interest. The question should be, what's best for the public? Now, here are five rules of thumb for when public services should not be privatized. Number one, don't privatize when the purpose of the service is to bring us together, reinforcing our communities, helping us connect with one another across class and race, linking up Americans who'd otherwise be isolated or marginalized. This is why we have a public postal service that serves everyone, even small rural communities where for-profit private carriers often won't go. This is also why we value public education and need to be very careful that charter schools and other forms of so-called school choice don't end up dividing our children and our communities rather than pulling them together. Number two, don't privatize when the service is less costly when paid for through tax revenues than through prices set by for-profit corporations. America's hugely expensive for-profit health insurance system, for example, is designed to sign up healthy people and avoid sick people while running up huge tabs for advertising and marketing and giving big rewards to shareholders and executives, which is why the administrative costs of Medicare are a tiny fraction of the cost of for-profit medical insurance. and why we need Medicare for all. Number three, don't privatize when the people who are supposed to get the service have no power to complain when services are poor. This is why for-profit prison corporations have proven again and again to violate the constitutional rights of prisoners, and why for-profit detention centers for refugee children at the border pose such grave risks. Number four, don't privatize when those who are getting the service have no way to know they're receiving poor quality. The marketers of for-profit colleges, for example, have every incentive to exploit young people and their parents because the value of the degrees they are offering can't easily be known, which is why nonprofit colleges and universities have proven far more trustworthy. Number five, finally, don't privatize where for-profit corporations face insufficient competition to keep prices under control. Giant for-profit defense contractors with power over how contracts are awarded generate notorious cost overruns because they're accountable mainly to their shareholders, not to the public. In other words, for-profit corporations can do some things very well, including, especially, maximizing shareholder returns. But when the primary goal is to serve the public rather than shareholders, we need to be careful not to sacrifice the public interest to private profits.
Standard way of privatizing something, like when Margaret Thatcher wanted to privatize the British railroads, the technique was defund them. And then when they don't work, people get angry. They say, let's do something. So you hand it over to private enterprise, which totally ruins them, and then the state has to come back in, big cost, and try to reconstruct it somehow. It's known as privatization. That's exactly what's happening with Social Security. It's in good shape now. When you read in the newspapers, as you do, that the big problem of the deficit is entitlements, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid. Social Security is a zero problem. For one thing, it doesn't add anything to the deficit because people pay for it. And for another thing, it's in pretty good shape. The last of the famous baby boomers will be gone before there's any problem in it. That's why there's a big payroll tax increase 30 years ago to ensure that. But if it's defunded, it'll be a problem. Then there'll be pressure to privatize it. That's a huge bonanza for the financial institutions. It'll put trillions of dollars into their hands, which they can then use to make a ton of money with risky investments, which are therefore very profitable. And when it tanks, as it will, when the economy tanks, there's a technique. You pick up your copies of Milton Friedman and Hayek and Ayn Rand, and you run to the nanny state that you've nurtured, and you make sure that they bail you out. That's really existing capitalism. And it means that the scam can go on.
Like, take privatizing schools. What's the point of privatizing schools? The idea is to instill in people the idea that all you care about is yourself. So I don't happen to have children of school age, so therefore, according to the ideology that's implanted in you, I'm not supposed to care whether the kid down the street has school to go to. So I don't want to pay taxes. I want to cut taxes because I don't care if that kid goes to school. Since I have enough money, I could send my kid to private school if I wanted to. So who cares if they're public schools? So we should privatize schools to eliminate the conception that we should care if some other kid goes to school, which everybody has. You got to drive it out of their heads. The same is true, I don't know if it's happening here, of efforts to privatize pension and security systems. What's the point of that? Like in the U.S., these big efforts to try to privatize Social Security. Financially speaking, it's ridiculous. It's a huge cost and everything else. But there are reasons for it. Social Security is based on an unacceptable principle, namely that each person, that you should care if the disabled widow across town survives. And you're not supposed to care about that. You're supposed to care about whether you have enough pairs of shoes and stuff like that, enough cars and video games or whatever it is. That's all you're supposed to care about. So you got to privatize Social Security. Also, another advantage to privatizing Social Security is that it has the brilliant consequence of turning working people against their own interests. Because if your pension is tied up in stocks, you want to make sure those stocks go up. And the way those stocks go up is by cutting wages and reducing working conditions and, you know, sending jobs to, you know, Chinese sweatshops and so on. So as a working person, you have to be committed to undermining your own interests. And that's important. So for reasons like that, you want to privatize Social Security and privatize water and schools and everything else.
By definition, privatization undercuts democracy. Takes something out of the public arena and puts it into the hands of unaccountable private tyrannies that are created and supported by the state, which is what corporations are.
Remember, all this privatization you hear about, it's supposed to be very efficient. And by some measure, you know, by some ludicrous measure, it probably is efficient. You know, and the part of the reason why it's efficient is you don't count the costs, okay? So, like, suppose they're talking about privatizing the MTA around here, you know, the public transportation thing. All right, suppose you privatize the system. You and I know how to make it more efficient by the economist's measures. You throw out union workers and you get temps for half the price. And if there's an accident because they never had any training, well, it's just people who are getting killed. You don't measure that. And you cut off the so-called unprofitable bus routes, okay, or subway routes. Like, you don't make a lot of money at 11 p.m., okay, so let's throw them out. Well, suppose somebody's stuck somewhere at 11 p.m. and wants to get home. Oh, well, you know, it's entrepreneurial values, you know. Let them hire a limousine or something, you know. In ways like that, you can make the system more efficient simply by transferring the costs over to the public where you don't measure the costs, okay? So, you know, it looks nice and efficient on some economists' paper, but of course, there's huge costs transferred over to the public, which you don't measure.
So I think that brings up something else that's pretty interesting, which is that, you know, I think especially since you brought up Clinton and the Democrats, lots of politicians like to sort of tout these so-called public-private partnerships, right? And I think at least the theoretical idea behind them is that the kind of public side of that partnership will sort of rein in the excesses of the private side of that partnership, but that the private side will, of course, you're already shaking your head. The private side will, of course, you know, sort of engender some kind of innovation or efficiency or whatever. And, you know, we just heard a great example of how that kind of unravels. But can you say a little bit more about why these partnerships don't actually work? Because could somebody just point to a few bad examples and say, well, those didn't work, but, you know, this idea is still good? What's wrong with public-private partnerships?
Well, first off, remember, everything's a public-private. When you're talking about infrastructure, roads, bridges, water systems, everything's a public-private partnership at some level because, you know, we hire companies to build them. So it's all private. You know, I believe, I haven't been able to do the analysis to turn, that public-private partnership is just a nicer term than privatization politically. So there's been a,
right.
You know, you see it much, much more over the last decade or so. So here's what's wrong. So the arguments for public-private partnerships are several. One is, as you said, private sector is more efficient. They'll have skin in the game and they'll make sure costs, stay down because of that. Second is, well, you know, the public sector doesn't have the money for, you know, the billions and trillions that we need to rebuild infrastructure, and there's tons of money sitting on the sidelines in the private sector. So, as you said, they'll be more innovative. So let's break that down. First off, at the practical level, they say, well, you know, there'll be no new taxes. You can do this with no new taxes. And the answer to that's real simple. There's really only borrowing the money to build something is the easy part. The hard part's paying it back, and there's only one place you get that money, and that's us. Taxes, tolls, and fees. There's no other magic money. So if you shift something from a tax to a toll or a tax to a fee, what's the difference to us? Nothing. So that's number one. Number two is, so there's plenty of money. That's kind of the point there. Mm-hmm. Second, they're going to do it cheaper, better. So let's just, you know, you look at that one. So they're going to do it cheaper means they're going to spend less money on something. Because efficiency is spend less money, put in less effort, get more. It's a fine concept. So we say, what are you going to spend less money on? And so, and it's a finite list of things you could spend less money on. You could spend less money on services. You know, one of the, I can't remember which road that was privatized, you know, the concession, you know, the road, you know, the rest stops closed down, or the quality of them went down because they weren't cleaned. You could pay the workers less, the people who maintain the road, and, you know, they do that. You could increase the tolls, which you do. That's not a savings, but of course that's the delta, that's the net. They do, because things cost money. And then finally, innovation, I think it's worth thinking about, because maybe someone's got a great idea. Some private sector person or company's got some great idea on how we could do something better. We can purchase that. We can purchase it, spend money, buy the idea from them if it's good. But keep control of the thing, because in the end, there's a massive amount of money being extracted because, you know, you've got returns to investors, you've got high executive compensation, you've got debt service for other deals they're doing. And so we're going to take a lot of money out that we could be using for infrastructure. And then, you know, as I was clear in the Chicago example, we lose control over some of it. There are non-compete clauses in road deals that prevent the public from upgrading roads that quote compete with that road or adding mass transit. So we sort of lose democratic control of those things. So that's the semi-short answer.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Well, I do want to return to your previous comments about privatization sort of eroding or undermining democracy, because obviously, you know, many proponents of privatization often talk about freedom, right? Like they're like, privatization means freedom from government bureaucracy, from, you know, various regulations and red tape. And that's the thing that kind of, you know, supposedly engenders the efficiency and innovation. Can you say a little bit more about how privatization actually hinders freedom, freedom of citizens, and or perhaps maybe the question is, why should we think of freedom differently than people who, you know, are pro-privatization?
That's a great question. So let's, first off, even before I get to that, privatization doesn't eliminate the responsibility of the public to carry out its purpose and mission. Mm-hmm. So it's the public purpose, and we decide that air should be clean. We pass the Clean Air Act and upgrades to that. We decide. So even if you, and you can go down the list, you know, Clean Water Act, you know, to make sure water is clean. Even if you give it to a private company, that doesn't mean the public is still in charge.
Yeah.
Right? So it doesn't eliminate regulations. It makes it harder to enforce those regulations. It creates interests in the provision of those services that want to fight regulations because they you know add cost to their private to their bottom line, so that's super important. So the thing about going to freedom, as we said earlier, markets exclude.
Yeah,
I mean it's a thing. It's I just say that in a very neutral, objective way. Nobody sell. If you're a business person and you operate in the market and you want to sell something, you don't sell things to people who don't have the money to buy it, right? It just doesn't make sense. I mean, we all know business people or people who own restaurants or whatever. You just don't do it. So, the going back to the original discussion of public goods is, if we need everyone to have access to clean air or to clean water or to health. If we put it in the market, we are eliminating people's freedom. I mean, you know, you're not free if you're struggling with college debt or if you're struggling without, you know, you can't pay for your health care bills and all that. That's not freedom. Freedom to exploit, freedom to, you know, everybody wants to do what they want to do. And businesses do that. I think I'll take it to another place, is that businesses do really one thing. They sell stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And what do they pay attention to? And it's just objectively, how many things they sell, how much it costs to make them, how many, what's the delta, what's the profit margin, what's the unit price, what's their market share? Anything that gets in their way, I mean, not anything, but things that get in their way that could work counter to those metrics, they say limit their freedom. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, it also limits our freedom when we give it to them.
Mm-hmm. I want to now ask you why privatization sort of became so widespread, because earlier you had alluded to the fact that it was sort of birthed out of these conservative think tanks, but actually, like, Reagan couldn't push it very hard. Couldn't push it very far despite his, you know, best intentions, or his, despite the fact that he tried very hard, and that the kind of consensus really only consolidated under the Clinton administration. How exactly did that happen? How did this become a bipartisan initiative, I suppose?
Well, there's a few things. One, as I mentioned earlier, was sort of, I mean, you know, when Clinton said the era of big government is over, mm-hmm. it's not just that he was a new Democrat. He was responding to the political environment. I mean, we can push that aside. He was. But sure. He was responding to the political environment that Reagan helped create. Mm-hmm. There really has been an assault on both the idea and the institution of government that's had great impact.
Yeah.
So he was, so I just take it out of, put it objectively, he was responding in that particular environment. Mm-hmm. So on one hand, conservatives and government, and corporations are all creating an assault on government because they don't want regulations and they want lower taxes and they want all these things. They want political control. So you've got, you're creating an environment that's favorable, right? Mm-hmm. You're also at the same time creating an environment that says, well, market's good, right? The market's really the better instrument. So there's sort of an idea project that's going on that has enormous impact. So that's number one. Number two is, what I said earlier, privatization became a strategy saying, well, if the private sector is more efficient, why not give it to them? Because we can do that and still, as an elected official or policymaker, still make sure we're providing the services. So, sort of these things all nest together. Then, of course, there's the growth of the lobby, right?
Yeah.
If you're the head of one of the two big private prison companies, you want a piece of that $90 billion that's spent every year in corrections. Mm-hmm. It's logical. And 20, maybe 30 years ago now, corporations were not really good at working at the city and state level, lobbying and, selling their wares. They really are now. Mm-hmm. They understand that the federal government's a bank. The money flows to the states, often to the states and the local governments, and that's where stuff happens.
Yeah.
The last thing that sort of I think is important in the strategic sense is that governments have been contracting for forever. That's not an issue. And so the other strategic insight is that the conservative theorists said, well, let's take this normal governing practice and turn it into an ideological piece of our agenda. Mm-hmm. So contracting out became something that everybody wanted to do. If you're certainly on the Republican side, on the conservative side, okay, our job is to go contract stuff out, because you also get to break unions and a whole other set of things. And so, last thing I'll say is back to public-private partnerships. We are swimming in an ideological sea that has been created over the last 40, 50 years. Government inefficient, private sector efficient. Mm-hmm. Now, we need to, on the left, we need to attack those. We need to smartly attack those ideas and push back on them in the right way. Mm-hmm. But, it's all the above.
Right, right.
This is a quick video where we discuss what privatization is. And we will also list some of the reasons why the government privatizes some of its services, operations, businesses, and properties. Welcome back to Public Administration 101, Quick Lesson Edition. Proudly brought to you by Kano Consultants. For professional advice you can trust, as indicated. In this video, we will discuss what privatization is. We will then list our 7 reasons why the government privatizes its services, operations, properties, and businesses. Now, let us get into today's video by first defining what privatization is. Privatization is the process of transferring services, operations, and assets owned by the public sector, which is the government, to the private sector. Essentially, privatization occurs when government-owned businesses and properties, as well as government services and operations, are transferred to and sometimes owned by, a private, non-government party. So, which types of government assets, services, and operations can be privatized? It is safe to say that there are many types of government services and operations, as well as government-owned assets, institutions, and facilities, which can be privatized and have been privatized. These includes, and not limited to, the following: correctional services and prisons, public schools and universities, healthcare and hospitals, roads and highways, airports and harbors, communication infrastructure, public services such as water, electricity, waste disposal, mail delivery, etc. There are various reasons why governments turn to privatization. In this next section, we list our 7 reasons why some governments elect to privatize their services, operations, properties, assets, institutions, and facilities. Cost reduction is often one of the motivations for privatization. Governments often outsource operations due to the potential of saving costs. The government would therefore have the private sector incur some of the costs, particularly when the government is facing financial challenges. The desire to transfer risk from the public sector to the private sector can also lead to privatization. Governments often desire to transfer risks of certain projects to the private sector. By contracting out for certain services, the public sector is then able to transfer the risks associated with those services to the private sector. Another rationale for privatization could be as a new source of revenue. The sale or lease of public assets can be used as a new revenue source. The privatization of toll roads, government businesses, buildings, and other properties can therefore be forms of new sources of revenue. The quality of service provided can also be a reason for privatizing a service or an asset. The private sector may be able to provide a higher level of service for a similar cost. Governments may be looking for a higher level of service but cannot provide it by themselves. The private sector may therefore be able to meet the level of service desired without raising costs. The lack of expertise within the government is another reason for privatization. The private sector may be able to have expertise that government does not wish to, or cannot even afford to provide, in-house. These kinds of services are often needed so rarely that it does not make financial sense for the government to maintain staff with these skills. The time frame required to complete a project can also lead to privatization. In certain situations, the government may have the skills to complete a project, but they may not be able to complete it within the desired time frame due to a lack of resources or even time. Therefore, the private sector can supplement government's efforts and ensure that the project keeps to the timelines. The final potential reason for privatization is the flexibility provided by the private sector. The government is often restricted in their operations as a result of their highly regulated environment. The government may therefore elect to privatize some of their operations due to the flexibility of the private sector in how they operate. We've come to the end of this video.
So nationalization or renationalization is one of those topics that kind of comes back periodically, doesn't it, Ben? Particularly when there are problems in industries and everyone's saying, what could be done?
Yeah, looking for alternatives. And the big question, would some of our big infrastructure projects, you know, be it public utilities like water or electricity or even things like the railways, be better run by the government? So that's the question. Yeah, morning to you. The pros and cons of bringing certain businesses back under state control, always discussed. But this week, well, it's resurfaced again for some pretty key reasons. Well, first up, there was that record fine, £126 million for Southern Water. That's because it leaked sewage and then covered up the problem for years. Critics say that's because of years of underinvestment by the private company. Well, then yesterday, the transport giant Stagecoach said it was not going to bid for any more rail franchises in the UK. It also runs some bus services. It's got a big stake in Virgin Trains, but it lost the East Coast franchise last year, and it's now been banned from bidding for three more, including the busy West Coast mainline, as well as East Midlands Trains too. So let's discuss both sides of the debate. With me here in the studio is Ellen Lees from the campaign group We Own It. She is in favour of nationalisation. And from our London studio is Matthew Lesh, who's from the Adam Smith Institute. He is against. Very good morning to you both. Adam, maybe I could start. I'm calling you Adam. From the Adam Smith Institute. Matthew, good morning to you. I want to start with you because we saw those two examples there this week, didn't we? Southern Water and, of course, Stagecoach. It proves, doesn't it, that big projects like that just don't work in private hands?
Look, I don't think that's true whatsoever. I think it's important to put privatisation in context. Before privatisation, you had to wait 3 months for a phone line. There was not irregular blackouts. There were burst water pipes and substantial leakage from the water system, and passenger numbers in trains were declining. Since privatisation, there has been huge investment in infrastructure that government just couldn't have done. If you take the case of water, there's been £160 billion of investment in water. That means that there's less leakage. It means the water quality, the drinking water we drink, has gone up. It means that more water is treated before it's put into the sea or rivers. It means cleaner environments. And if you even just look at a comparison between England and Wales and Scotland, where Scotland water is nationalised, up in Scotland there is twice as much water leakage. If you compare to Northern Ireland, where, again, water is nationalised, there's persistent complaints about underinvestment. And that's because what happens when industries are nationalised and owned by the government, there's substantial costs involved. And often government doesn't prioritise the investment infrastructure. Alone nationalising water will cost £90 billion. On top of that, there's ongoing costs for maintenance, and that's money that can't be spent on hospitals, it's money that can't be spent on schools, and it can't be spent on defence. And as a result, in the end, you end up with poor quality services, and with services that aren't responsive to consumers, and really an awful situation with this infrastructure being dilapidated.
Yeah, Matthew, I want to bring in Ellen at this point, because you're therefore saying that actually the money would be better spent, and private firms can spend that money. Ellen, can they? Because if we look at the cases of this week, they've just not been doing that. Underinvestment was the reason for the Southern Water problem.
Well, yeah, clearly not. We've seen the evidence again and again that private companies don't make the necessary investment. You know, the 160 billion figure that Matthew quoted in the water industry, all of that has been covered by customers' bills, which were massively hiked when it was privatised and are now 40% higher in real terms than they were before privatisation. All of the investment could have been covered by customers' bills. Water is a profitable industry. It is not rocket science to reinvest that profit and make the necessary investment. In Scotland, they invest more per capita than English water companies do. And bills are £40 lower, roughly. So, you know, it's just not true that private companies will make the necessary investment. The investment they do make is because it is legally required of them to do. For example, the EU regulations for cleaning up our rivers, which was why they made investment in the early 90s. They don't do it out of the goodness of their hearts. They're not paying for it out of their own pocket. And I don't see why a publicly owned company couldn't make the same investment, reinvest the profit and make a better service.
Yeah, I mean, Matthew, when we look at that, though, private ownership, you know, the process of franchises, essentially what we're creating are monopolies. These rail companies, for example, have huge monopolies on those lines. Even though we say they don't, they're the only firm that's able to operate. That means there's no incentive to cut prices or make the system any better, make the service any better.
Look, I completely agree. And that's why for quite a number of years, the Adam Smith Institute has actually advocated for open access on trains, which means rather than
open access,
this existing
Matthew, we know that open access doesn't work. I'm sorry to interrupt, but you know, you've got one train operating on one line. You can't put more trains on that line. Virgin Trains
in this case had
the monopoly.
You can actually run different trains at different times. There are open access lines in the UK where prices for passengers are lower and where customer satisfaction is much higher. It's not impossible to have different operators having allocated different times on the train line, competing for customers. I do completely agree that the monopoly franchise system has failed and needs to end, and hopefully the government does do that as part of the Williams Well review that's going on at the moment. And it does facilitate more competition, because I think you're completely right.
Yeah.
The purpose of privatisation is not just to get things out of government hands. It's to enable competition so that there's better passenger outcomes, so there's high-quality services and
in
innovation.
Reality,
yeah,
in most public services, there is a natural monopoly. You're absolutely right. And open access on the rail would just increase the fragmentation, which is the cause of the problems that we're having. It would mean that there are more ticket choices, more confusion, more chaos, less cooperation between the different parts of the railway. It's just going in completely the wrong direction, and it's not the solution.
Ellen, Matthew, we could continue this conversation all day. I'm really sorry we're out of time, but it's really interesting to hear your thoughts on all of that and about what happens next.
I think that brings us now to the question of where we are with privatization now, right? Because I think in 2020, COVID and the pandemic sort of, at least for me, like laid bare many of the harmful consequences of privatization. Like I think a lot of people started to see that or started to call more attention to that. And of course, the next year, Joe Biden takes office, at least partly on the pledge that, you know, he wants to sort of revitalize parts of the public sector, infrastructure and so on. I think you could argue that his administration has tried to do that to some degree through, you know, bills like Build Back Better. Obviously, those legislative efforts have found mixed success due to being hampered in Congress and so on and so forth. And I should also say, though, at the same time, it looks like his administration is continuing a number of, you know, Trump-era privatization schemes, like moving to privatize Medicare. So I suppose, you know, in this moment, do you see the federal government or, you know, legislative bodies in general actually working to curb or roll back privatization at all? And then maybe, like, a second part to that question is, because obviously privatization is still going on, where does it seem to be ramping up most today?
Okay, that's a bunch. Okay,
sorry, so yeah, that was a few.
Okay, so first, the good news.
Yeah.
I mean, first off, I never said the Biden administration. The Biden administration's doing something. I mean, he's got, you know, they have certain powers over things. They've done some good executive orders that raise the bar on contracting, which is super important. You know, raise wages and other things. So the other thing to note about Build Back Better is we came kind of two votes away from universal child care.
Mm-hmm.
That's a significant shift in American politics and governance, right? Creating an entirely new public good. So that's, you know, I mean, it's fundamentally, essentially, because we all need, you know, child care. I mean, everybody needs child care. So, you know, broadband, lots of money for broadband. There's a lot. I mean, there's the infrastructure bill, Build Back Better. There's a lot of money flowing, and that's actually pretty good.
Yeah.
Second, in terms of, are there people pushing back at the federal level? You know, I'm sure. We don't, you know, I wouldn't want to be in Congress right now. You know, there's lots of efforts to slow down, mostly unsuccessful, but actually we had some success on slowing down the growth of charter schools, because public education is under full-scale assault in America by not just CRT, that's the sideshow,
right?
Vouchers and charters. We are creating parallel systems of education. And a new regulation is in process right now. I think it was finally adopted. That would be helpful in the use of the charter school money that comes from the federal government. I won't get into the weeds. So it's a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, folks are fighting at the federal level. At the state and local level, yes. I mean, because again, I think most of this is happening at the state and local level.
Right.
Look at prisons. There's mostly state. You know, federal government doesn't have that many prisons in the end. Healthcare moves. You know, Medicare goes through the states. Education happens at the states. Infrastructure happens at the states. The federal government is just a bank. And so, on the negative side, you know, there are red states all over the country that are passing voucher initiatives and increasing the number of charters available and, you know, passing preemption laws and, you know, full-scale assault and everything. And we could talk about that forever on democracy in every which way. In other places, there's, you know, although even that, you know, there was a, you know, this is all in the weeds, even in Tennessee, one of the reddest of the red states at this point, was has, you know, there's backlash against some of the governor's efforts to create school vouchers and charter schools by not just Democrats, by Republicans, because it take because of the specifics, it takes away local control. Some of the what the government wants to do takes away local control. So there's pushback in many places. Mm-hmm. There are organizations and unions and others that are fighting and winning. Mm-hmm. There are water systems that are being remunicipalized, brought back in-house because it's cheaper and better and more, you know, and more public control. So it's a pitched battle.
Yeah.
But the final thing I'd say to remember is that there are corporations, huge corporations, and including Wall Street, right, because they've got all this cash to invest in, that want a piece of the, I think we're up to $9 or $10 trillion spent, you know, by governments in America. Mm-hmm. They're not going away. So they're operating at the ideal level, not ideological. Mm-hmm. That's government bad, inefficient, yada, yada.
Right.
And we've got the answers. And plus, you know, if you're a mayor and you've got problems and your water system, I was just in Jackson, Mississippi, and your mm-hmm. water system has fallen apart, and somebody comes to you and says, we could do it cheaper, we could do it better, we could even do it more expensively, but it won't be your problem anymore. I would consider seriously taking that deal because it's a lot. So, you know, there's good news and bad news all over the country.
Right. I think then I want to wrap up on kind of this ideological question, because something that you get at in your book is, you know, obviously after many, many decades of widespread privatization, the government's capacity and capability to kind of deliver for its citizens has been severely undermined in many ways. And I think, you know, that is obviously very dangerous because that in turn lowers public trust in the government. And, you know, if you have low trust in the government, why are you going to vote for politicians who want to expand the public sector, which you already see as kind of like, you know, non-functioning or, you know, something that is like a huge pain to you, right? So how exactly do we break out of this vicious cycle, or like, how do we start to break out of it?
Well, I'll answer both. How do we break out and how do we start? We have to think long, first off. Now, think long, you don't act long, you act today. Right. So that's why it's start now, but also think long. Is that, you know, we have to shift that environment. And that's one thing we have to do. And I think there's two sides to that. On one side, we had to what I'm calling now, we need a street level critique of neoliberalism. Right. Privatization, deregulation. They say more efficient. They say the profit motive, you know, makes things better. They say competition makes things better. We need to critique. I mean, and so there's truth in all those things. There's efficiencies and competition can do good things in certain places, you know, listed on the ball field. But we have to say that those are not universal truths. They have real distortions and we have to attack them, you know, in a serious way. Anyway, so that's one. I could go into each one of those things. The other thing is then we have to lift up, you know, I used to believe that one of our central tasks are we have to rebuild trust in government. I believe something a little different now. I think our central task as progressives is to rebuild commitment and to the idea of public.
Mm-hmm.
Right? There are things, like I said at the beginning, that the things that we can only do if we do them together. Mm-hmm. Right? And so, and then the institutions are ours to always make better, to battle over, because democracy is a battlefield. That's right, and that always will be. We need to battle over, we need to battle control, but we also have to continually be out there making them better.
Yeah.
Governments are really complicated. It's the most complicated institution in civilized history in America, you know, American governments. So we have to do that. The second. The other part of that, though, is we on the left are often, in the, you know, at least the past in my professional life, have been helping the right wing in fomenting distrust of government, right? Mm-hmm. For several reasons. It fails in some places. Cops are killing black kids. That's for real. Or OSHA failed to, you know, to enforce a regulation that, you know, that caught, you know, in an accident in a plant happened. They're complicated institutions.
Right.
But if we're not, if the right wing is attacking the idea of government and the institution of government, and we are too, because we want it to do better, we want to pass new laws, but we're not defending the institution, even if the progress, even if incomplete and not perfect, then what do we expect to happen?
Right.
One of the things you may have caught in the book is I say one of the things we need to do is called surface the state.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Right? It's all around us, and it ain't all bad. The water comes out of the tap every time I turn around. Now, I live in L.A. The water's decent. The paint on our walls used to have lead in it. It doesn't because of public action. Mm-hmm. So we have to be able to hold two things in our head. It isn't perfect. There's lots to do, but there are things that are good, and we need to make the people aware of that always. It's got to be the same kind of drumbeat. And then finally, we have to be the reformers. We have to make contracting better. We have to make, you know, government better. We need to root out corruption. We need to, you know, we need high quality management and high quality trained staff. So we should be sending lots of people into bureaucracies, not just elected office, to actually run the thing, because it's not easy. If you and I were running, the city of Los Angeles, we'd mess up too. Right. It's, you know, so we have to, you know, I think it's a multiple thing. We need a governing reform agenda, and we need to attack the idea frame as well.
I'm here today with Professor Wendy Brown, professor of political science at University of California, Berkeley. We're here to discuss her book, Undoing the Demos, Neoliberalism's Stealth Revolution, published in March of 2015 by Zone Books. Wendy, thanks for joining us.
It's a pleasure.
Neoliberalism's Stealth Revolution. What does that mean?
What I wanted to do in this book was take us a little past the usual understandings of neoliberalism, and I'll say just a word about that. Conventionally, we understand it as a reaction to Keynesianism, a reaction to the welfare state, a promulgation of free markets, an insistence that markets left alone and ungoverned by states, not intervened in by governments, and produced everywhere and for everything, would just make the best possible world for all. And certainly there is that dimension to neoliberalism.
So that you're saying that in that scheme, anything the state does is inefficient or detracts from the potential well-being of society.
Well, most neoliberals will acknowledge that the state should be in charge of defense, provide basic security, secure rights.
Okay.
Now, the content of those things is another question. Most neoliberals will argue that even there's room for markets, that the state ought to do those things by producing markets in them, but still needs to be in charge of them. But close that bracket for the moment. For the most part, neoliberalism is understood as something that is about letting markets have their way and keeping the state out of the picture, except for defense, for securing rights, and for providing national security. But I wanted to take the problem of neoliberalism a little further and explore something that it's done to political life, to social life, and to the human being. And that's where the stealth revolution comes in. What many neoliberals, especially those writing and thinking and arguing on behalf of neoliberalism in the 40s, the 50s, the 60s, argued for, wasn't just free markets, but the expansion of markets understood as competition to every feature of life, including democracy, including human social life, including education, social services, and so forth. So the idea wasn't just let free markets have their way, but produce everything in the image of a market. And that's where the stealth revolution comes in, because that's where the transformation of the human being and the transformation of democracy itself begins to unfold. And I think those are the things we probably want to talk about
and
together.
And so the title, Undoing the Demos,
yes,
is what the stealth revolution
right
is.
So above all, what I'm concerned with in this book is the way that turning democracy itself into a marketplace, converting the terms of democracy, the basic understanding of democracy, into a marketplace, literally undoes democracy. And what I mean there is that if democracy is understood in its most basic way as rule of the people, rule of the demos, that's the ancient Greek idea, demos kratia, the people rule. Once you take democracy and make it into a marketplace, you get rid of some pretty fundamental principles of democracy. And these include making equality a first principle, sharing political power equally, And having the people themselves decide what to value and decide what a particular polity ought to do, ruling themselves. And the reason you get rid of those when you convert democracy into a marketplace is that marketplaces aren't supposed to have people ruling. They're just supposed to have everyone pursuing their own interest. Mm-hmm. And they aren't supposed to have equality. They're supposed to have the naturalness of inequality that comes with competition. So some of the most basic features of democracy get undone by marketizing it. And that's what this book is concerned with.
Now, in reading this book, the other dimension, which I think is very sophisticated and important that you bring out, is that you are not just romanticizing democracy as an alternative to this system. You deal with the tensions of how expertise and representation and the structure of governance affects the well-being of people. And the notion that what I call pure representative democracy as an ideal has certain attractions, like you said, of sharing of power, making sure everyone's heard. But there are tensions within that, and there are people like the ordo-liberals who would like to have a hierarchy of more expert people choosing what to do for the well-being of society.
Right.
But that has its vulnerabilities as well.
Yes. Democracy is always an unrealized dream. And it's not as if we once upon a time had it and then neoliberalism undid it. There's always been, in modern societies, a tension between capitalism and democracy, between the inequalities that capitalist societies generate and the ideal of including all, sharing power among all, having an egalitarian political order. But the ideal was sustained by understanding democracy and capitalism as something other than identical. Understanding democracy as something that societies had to try to aspire to and carve out a space for, and markets as something that were appropriately confined to an economic sphere.
And they're a tool
exactly
to facilitate the well-being
right
of the body politic.
But what's changed, and even the classical political economists, Adam Smith, Adam Ferguson, and others, never argued that democracy itself or the state itself should be economized, should be turned into a market. They simply argued that where there were markets, laissez-faire should be appropriate, but they never argued that everything should be marketized. So democracy has always been in tension with markets, but at least was cultivated by honoring its basic principles and attempting to expand those to include more peoples. For example, those historically disenfranchised, African Americans in the U.S., women, other peoples who were excluded, and also expand rights and expand possibilities for opportunity and expand possibilities for participation as citizens. What's changed, what neoliberalism has done by economizing democracy, is saying there's no special space for democracy anymore. There's just markets everywhere, and everything should be understood on a market model.
It used to be said that capitalism derives its moral legitimacy from being governed by democracy.
There you go. Yes.
But now the buying and selling of the rules of the game or the enforcement of the rules tears apart that legitimacy.
Exactly.
And what's happened in response to that at some times and in some places is that people question whether we need democracy at all.
Exactly.
Some people point to a Chinese authoritarian government as an example of something that works, that delivers the service. Others say democracy doesn't work because it requires expertise, sophistication, and a hierarchy.
Right.
And people can't, how do you say, collectively rise up to that, whether it's because of emotional contagion or whether it's because of lack of education, something we should talk about here, because you can't destroy education and depend on democracy.
So let's hold that for just a second, but first talk about what you just mentioned in a really, I think, useful provocation, which is once democracy starts to be challenged by the ubiquitousness of markets, and markets understood as the best way to organize everything. Once that challenge happens, the capacity of people to argue for democratic will, democratic governing, becomes really weakened. Markets become the solution to everything. And when that happens, you get a cycle, the one you just described, which is markets do what they will, even if they're producing greater inequalities, even if they're producing tremendous volatility and instability, even if they're crashing certain economies altogether, certain nations, producing the situation that we have today in Puerto Rico or in Greece or elsewhere. Markets are still understood to be the best way of governing. And then you get the problem of democracy itself being essentially what you're describing, delegitimized as a response or a retort or a solution to the inequalities or maldistributions or utter disasters that markets sometimes generate.
And this creates a spiral, because when the government doesn't perform well, the lobbies to dismantle the government reduce their funding, reduce their training, reduce the quality of talent that they can aspire to putting in senior positions.
Right, so then you get that terrible spiral.
That disintegrates.
Right.
And government can't function, and therefore it validates the cynic.
Right, so it looks like a bad form of organizing society, and increasingly what you get are, on the one hand, the idea that markets themselves should govern, or that the philanthropic desires of, and I'm saying this, you know, with Silicon Valley 20 miles away from us as we speak, the philanthropic desires of the head of Microsoft or the head of Facebook or whatever else ought to be making the major political moves and decisions for our society. So increasingly, the understanding of how we should organize ourselves is either let the markets rule or let the rich rule, and let the rich make decisions about how do we fix education or how do we respond to poverty in North Africa or how do we respond to disintegration of an inner city or something like that. And it becomes up to the Zuckerbergs and the Gates and so forth, who are understood as not only experts at what they do, but now become essentially the new rulers. That's the non-nefarious side. The nefarious side is the one you just described, where those who are able to essentially buy legislation by making tremendous contributions to candidates for office, and then making those contributions based on a quid pro quo, a tacit quid pro quo, if I get you elected, then you will make sure that...
So people are pre-selling policy.
They're pre-selling policy. And it's just become, you know, most people know this is the case. And as you say, people kind of, as a result, become very cynical. But I think also what we have now is a kind of deep confusion and even despair about what else could possibly run our world.
Yes.
So when you combine that with the fact that there are, and I'm now picking up an earlier point you mentioned, those who believe that democracy is just a bad way to run an economy and a bad way to run the globe, and I think this touches on some of what's going on with the European Union crisis and other things, you get the conviction that it really at this point ought to simply be a matter of experts who have the authority to decide which policies should be pursued, which policies should be avoided, where austerity ought to be imposed, where it ought to be, where certain kinds of arrangements between financial institutions and states and public services ought to be organized. And increasingly we have a belief on the one hand that that ought to be organized by experts, and a despair on the other that governments are hopeless, markets are out of control, the world is too complex and too vast, and it's either doomsday or I'll just go shopping.
Class war, class war, class war. Now, Jim, Show this gentleman how you can dance and sing.
That's my attitude towards the Western powers. If you want to say there's no rules, fine. Don't go crying for your mummy when that comes.
America today finds herself in a unique situation. She's the only country in history in a position to become involved in a bloodless revolution.
If America does not respond creatively to the challenge to banish racism, some future historian will have to say that a great civilization died because it lacked the soul and commitment to make justice a reality for all men.
When the system doesn't work for the majority of the people, you gotta change the system.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. I'm your brother, Bahamir Diz Ogaya. Welcome to this Class War Battlefield Podcast episode. I have recorded a couple of these already, but I just recently decided to call them what they actually are, which is article reactions. So what I'm going to do is read this article for you, and I am going to, in real time, obviously react and respond and comment and what have you to what I am reading. And look, there are many people who do something similar, but they typically take a snippet of the article. The reason I want to go through and read the entire article is because, one, a lot of people aren't reading, and two, some of these articles are really, really fascinating and really good, and I learned a bunch from them, but I also like to point out some of the hypocrisies. and this one particularly has a blatant hypocrisy immediately. I mean, it's not something that you can like explain away and be like, well, they, you know, it could be. No. This is a huge blatant hypocrisy. So growing up in the small town that I grew up in, it wasn't tiny, but it wasn't big. One of the major problems that everybody complained about, particularly as the mid-90s hit and privatization took over the state-owned, and I think it was owned and operated, electric company, was the rate hikes that were arbitrary and just seemed to happen. In fact, it was so bad at one point, after Obama was elected, there was major talk of putting windmills in the countryside of the community to power the entire community, which, you know, there's tons of country area, so it wouldn't have taken much to do that. There's a lot of hills and everything, so it could have been done. Well, the privately owned, formerly public utility company sued to stop the county and the community that I lived in specifically from doing that. Why? Because I suspect they understood that once that occurred, people's account, the amount that they were paying each year was going to drop so significantly that there was going to start being questions of how New York State Electric and Gas was actually conceiving of the bills that they were sending people. Now, this this theory of mine was seemingly confirmed. During the Trump administration, I moved from an apartment that had electricity included in its rent to an apartment that didn't. And my first year over here, in fact, my first 2 years over, the cost of electricity was pretty reasonable. I think my first year over here, I spent just under $100, which was really good. And then the second year, it was, you know, like $120, $130, nothing bad. But then my third year, it jacked up like $50. And in my fourth year, it was like $210. And I called and was like, no, there's something wrong here. I'm living in a small apartment. I'm not even home most of the time. So what's going on here? Well, towards the end of last year, something happened with the federal government because I received a letter in the mail. We had been overcharging you, blah, 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 blah. Boom, you only owe this much. It literally was cut in half. And in fact, it went a little bit less than cut in half. I'm not a fan of private utilities. Anything that people need, underline the word need, to survive, should be government-owned, municipal-owned, county-owned. It should never be in private hands. Why? Because greedy people don't deserve that much power. They don't. They don't know how to behave themselves, so you keep that out of their hands. That's just how it should be. Now, let's look at this article. And for those of you who think that that's a little bit harsh, look, I'm a person who believes in, you know, when a person tells you who they are, when a person shows you who they are, you better believe them. And greedy rich people have showed you who they are. You better believe them. They can't be trusted with things that are vital to people's health and well-being. This is why the United States has one of the most horrendous healthcare systems in the world, because we keep trying to rely on wealthy people to do what's right. It's not in their capacity to do what's right. So even if you think some of them may have the capacity, that's great, that's awesome, and there's probably some who do, you don't give any length of possibility to the ones who don't. So here we go. This is from, and yes, get ready to laugh, this is from Bloomberg Magazine. The privatization of public health, public utilities has one major upside. Subtitle: when it comes to complying with important health regulations, private companies far outperform the public sector. Mm-hmm. This is by Laura Bliss, published in 2015. When local governments turn to private companies to manage vital utilities like water, energy, and public health, the poorest customers often lose. I want you to note how that starts off. And I want you to sear that into the back of your mind. Because the argument that is immediately put forward is, when it comes to complying with important health regulations, private companies far outperform the public sector. So, if she starts off with that little tidbit in the subtitle, and then she immediately goes to, when local governments turn to private companies to manage vital utilities like water, energy, and public health, the poorest customers often lose. That's a major contradiction. That's a huge contradiction. Because if you're starting off with telling me that the private companies comply with important health regulations better than government ones do, and yet the poorest customers often lose, there's a contradiction there. Because if you're going to comply with health regulations, there's an assumption that you're going to then be able to make your product, your services, available to more people, including those who are poor. And maybe that's just wrong for me to assume, but there's a contradiction there. Continuing, by law, private utilities can set their rates based directly on the cost of their investments. So the beginning of this of this piece says that private companies who are running these vital utilities often cause the poor to lose. And they do so by jacking up prices. Again, by law, private utilities can set their rates based directly on the cost of their investments, which means they can charge a lot with little concern for how that impacts low-income customers or consumers. By the way, for public utilities or for vital utilities, those would be citizens, not consumers. I'm big on this idea of separating consumers from citizens and wanting to see people more as consumers than citizens, because a consumer doesn't have many rights. A citizen does. Continuing. Unlike public utilities, private utilities do not serve a constituency. They serve investors. And investors are notoriously greedy. She didn't write that part. I put that in there. But according to a forthcoming paper in the American Journal of Political Science, the public utility model has some drawbacks, too. Its reliance on public support can compromise its ability to make crucial infrastructure upgrades. Okay. Let's back up a little bit. How many of you have worked for a big company and watched as that big company micromanaged every little thing that you wanted to order to make your job better and to make your job easier? How many of you have watched a publicly traded investor-rich company making hundreds of millions or billions of dollars in profit not invest in machines or equipment or whatever because they can get a little bit more life out of it, and so they won't invest that money even though it would be easier for you and easier for other employees? The gall of this financial writer to And whoever wrote this paper from the American Journal of Political Science, to state that the reliance on public support, which, by the way, I know corporations like to act as if they're not reliant on public support, but newsflash, corporation, you are part of a society which is part of a large society, and the people who are your, quote, consumers, back in the day they called a consumer was an extension of being a citizen, so to call you a citizen was more apt and more appropriate. Those people are part of the public. When you talk about dissecting markets in penetrating markets, you're talking about the public. You're talking about groups of people. Corporations, yes, they don't serve the public. It's very clear they don't serve the public because they do a lot of things that are destructive to the public. Maybe, just maybe, they should serve the public a little bit more instead of serving greedy investors and their own egos. This is appalling, that statement. Where do you think your employees come from? Some magical place that's detached from planet Earth? Where do you think the people who consume your products or your services come from? Some magical place that's detached from the universe? They come from the public. See, I'm starting to really appreciate one of the primary reasons why capitalists hate Marx. Because Karl Marx made it impossible for them to separate economy from society and community. He made it impossible for them to separate the economy from the public. Continuing. In reliance on public support, or its reliance on public support, can compromise its ability to make crucial infrastructure upgrades. As a result of poor funding, public utilities can also fail to meet federal public regulations. This is an amazing statement, because saying that public utilities, because it lacks funding, can't upkeep its regulations and what have you, is hilarious. Again, this is written in Bloomberg, a magazine, a newspaper, whatever you call it, that advocates cutting taxes for the rich. Taxes which they should owe because they're not paying their employees what they should be paying their employees. They're not paying the local communities what they need to be paying the local communities for being in that community, for having access to those people, for having access to the societies within that community. They're not paying for that. So if public utilities are underfunded, it's because the people, the larger corporations who are using them, don't want to pay their fair share in helping to keep those Commonwealth entities up to date. Corporations really do kind of have a psychopathic way of viewing themselves in the world. They owe nobody nothing, but everybody owes them something. Continuing. And yet, regulators are more lenient with them than with public utilities, since harsh punishment only further hurts the public. Now, it's also possible that they're a little bit less lenient when it comes to corporations, because typically, corporations have the power to actually pay for influence. And so when the corporation finally gets to the point where it is doing something that requires the government to come down on it, it typically has done a lot of things prior which the government hasn't come down on it for, but they are now starting to hurt people, literal people. If public utilities did that, the government would come down on them for that. Moreover, the government may also look and say, well, we're not going to come that, you know, down that hard on a lot of these public utilities because, again, corporations and rich people don't like to pay their goddamn taxes. At the same time, they're not willing to pay their employees living wages. Continuing, public utilities need to please voters. I almost don't want to read that section because it's like, I already see where this is all going. So, when public utilities try to increase their rates to pay for an infrastructure upgrade or a new treatment plant, city council members or local commissioners have to vote to approve those rates. Those voting officials are tied to a constituency. For example, about 85% of Americans get their water from a public utility, whether from a city, county, or special district. Particularly in the dry states of the West, water rate increases are a hot potato for local officials. Residents of one tiny poor town in Fresno County, California, recently voted down a proposed $30 monthly increase to their water bills, even though it may mean having their taps turned off. That story has become a well-publicized political minefield. People are sensitive to water rate increases in the way they are to tax increases, said Manuel Teodoro, an associate professor of political science at Texas A&M, what they couldn't get someone out of California, and one of the authors of the new paper. In local politics, it becomes a huge issue. Yeah, again. But my question is, how much of this is due to the fact that corporations aren't paying their fair share? Corporations like to come out and talk about how ordinary people need to pay their fair share, but they never seem to point the finger in the other direction and say, we owe something bigger because we are bigger. I have an episode which I haven't published yet, but it's in the chamber. I'm actually prepping it to be published. And it is explaining how the work that you do, when you go in and you are employed by some company who doesn't want to pay you a living wage, who doesn't want to invest in things that you need to do your job right, you need to be in favor of higher taxes for those people. Because that was the idea behind Roosevelt's move to tax them higher. They didn't want to pay their employees. They didn't want to invest in safety mechanisms. They didn't want to invest in equipment. They didn't want to invest in anything, really. And so Roosevelt said, fine, you don't want to invest in it, we're going to tax you. Now, if you want to do all these things, those are called tax credits. And you can ease the amount of taxes that you're paying according to how much you are actually paying your employees, putting money back into equipment, putting money into the local economy, things like that. If you have a local, not only bank account that you use for business, but you also keep money there, all this stuff, that was the idea of the higher tax rate. Continuing, Teodora and co-author David Kaninsky, an associate professor of public affairs at Indiana University, argue that because rate hikes are so politically sticky, it's harder for public utilities to generate the revenue required for crucial infrastructure updates or even simple maintenance. Now, here's what's funny, and maybe they'll do this later. Why are rate hikes so sticky? You notice conservatives and capitalist apologists use stuff like this. They'll say these open-ended statements without any context, without any explanation, and then they'll kind of back off like, oh yeah, just, you know, it's what it is. It's what it's always been. Why are rate hikes so sticky? Rate hikes are so sticky because people are living close to the edge. A $30 a month increase may not be nothing for this Bloomberg writer. Because what's 30 bucks for somebody making $80,000, $90,000 a year? Or maybe more. But for a person who is making $30,000 or $35,000 or $40,000 a year, and that's pre-tax, $30 a month is significant. Now, you might say, well, yeah, but that's why all taxes should be gotten rid of. Don't be foolish. As one of the elders that I love listening to says, man, you open up your mouth and expose your whole brain. You don't understand why taxes are really here. You don't understand what they do. And you do not understand who the real enemy is when it comes to taxes and tax problems. The tax is not the problem. Let me explain something to all y'all who's on this whole, just get rid of taxes. If you were making $95,000 a year, you were paying a tax that was equivalent to 30, drop you down to 60. Yes. And I'm talking all taxes. I'm talking about stuff you're paying for your school, the federal tax, which I don't believe it'll be that pronounced where it'll drop you down to 60. But I'm even including the money that you might put away in your 401k, which will take out your tax burden or take down your tax burden. You wouldn't give a damn about it if you were making $90,000 and it only dropped you down to $60,000, because you'd still be making over $1,000 a week. And I know some of you just went, ooh, I wish. That's the point. The taxes were so high on the wealthy because the wealthy weren't paying you what they should have been paying you. Now we're to the point where everyone's just, get rid of taxes, just get rid of taxes, just get rid of taxes. Ladies and gentlemen, if you give the wealthy more money, they are not going to do anything but hoard it. That's why you tax them into the ground until they become more egalitarian. You give them ways out, but you make sure those ways benefit the people who they're exploiting. I guarantee you, if tomorrow the government passed and threatened to enforce a tax break, well, first, they reinstituted the 90% upper income tax, which would be today probably $25 to $50 million and up. And then they threatened, or not threatened, but they passed and threatened to enforce a tax rebate for companies who promised to pay all their employees at least $75,000 a year. And they said, yeah, well, you know, you can write off the increase for the first 10 years. You know, you can write off up to 50% of that on your taxes. I guarantee you something. Corporations would hike taxes. Oh, and you put in a provision that says prices of whatever you're selling can't go up more than 10%. Or else you lose that tax break. And you can't hike it, you know, year over year. You have to hike it within these parameters or whatever. I guarantee you overnight, people would be making more money. Because that's how these people's brains work. Continuing. By contrast, private utilities have no problem setting high rates and building new pipes and plants. In fact, they are incentivized to raise rates because that's how they turn a profit. Investor-owned utilities want more in want more and more stable revenue, says Teodoro. Now look, here's the thing. Investor-owned utilities do not want more stable revenue. They just want more revenue. That's it. They don't give a damn how stable it is, just as long as they get more. And to believe that public utilities are so disastrously managed and so disastrously out of shape because people don't like rate hikes is ridiculous. Again, it is because people don't like to pay their darn taxes. And it's specifically the wealthy. Continuing. That means resource-challenged public utilities can be more likely to fail to meet federal environmental and health regulations. Ooh. Than resource-rich private utilities. Yes, and here's the funny thing about that. Even these resource-rich private utility companies aren't striving for those regulations. One of the things that people used to argue when it came to capitalist investor-owned companies and why they were so much better than anything socialism could ever do was because these companies had a stake. Oh, they had a stake in making the world better. So they wouldn't mess up the environment or they would be on the cutting edge of implementing programs that saved and protected the environment, because why would they want to hurt the place that they're operating in? Obviously, you could tell by the way that I'm talking. This is complete bull. This is complete bull. In Enron underscored how bull this was. This statement is ridiculous. These people aren't going to spend their stable revenue aren't abiding by regulations. They're going to spend their stable revenue on abiding by paying people all kinds of money so they could go out and be rich. Continuing, unlike public utilities, private companies also have competitors, oh Jesus, which also incentivizes them to staff up, build out, and comply with federal standards. I swear to God, what is... And comply with federal standards. What? Like, this author cannot believe any of this nonsense. Has she... Does she know what she's talking about here? I'm not saying that these people don't try to abide by some regulations, because they do. I've worked at many places that, you know, they did the bare minimum regulations, but they made sure to do the bare minimum. I worked one place where I'm hoping it got better, but it was rough. It was rough. They made like hair care, skin products, and stuff like that, and the machines were just disgusting. Disgusting. And I remember one day I was like, yo, let's do some cleaning here, because we had some time down. And the one lady who had been there for like 5-6 years, she was like, you can go ahead and try, but a lot of that stuff ain't coming off. And she's like, it peels off periodically, and you have to kind of catch it before it hits, you know, any of the other stuff. But yeah, that stuff ain't coming off. And I watched over the couple of months that I was there where it just like gunked on, gunked on. Like, oh my God, this place is horrible. But they did the bare minimum, so they passed regulation. Always. Always. Continuing. Teodoro and Koreski studied rates of public agency and private firm compliance with the FBA regulated Clean Air Act and Safe Drinking Water Act between 2000... in 2011, in 2010, and 2013, respectively, in both cases, public power plants, healthcare providers, and water agencies failed to comply with a range of regulations. For example, how often inspections occurred, amount of emissions, health of local groundwater, at a significantly higher rate than those that were privately out. Now, I don't know where they were studying these places. I don't know where they were and look, again, I don't know where they were studying these places, but what it sounds like they did was they went into, like, poor, possibly rural or inner city areas where tax revenue is drying up, and they were like, okay, yep, we'll test it here, we'll test it here. And then they went to really good, you know, suburban, white, a lot of wealth, you know, place, and they were like, yeah, let's test out here. And yeah, that's what that sounds like, but who knows. Continuing, government loves government, of course, because this is Bloomberg, you know, we hate government. Unless we're paying them off to do what we want. Not only were public utilities less likely than privates to comply with those federal regulations, but federal regulators were less likely to impose severe punishment on them. One reason is that fining a city is essentially punishing the public that both government bodies are supposed to serve. Another is because public utilities are often monopoly providers of essential services, so threatening to revoke their license would be an empty threat. Here's, no they didn't. No, they didn't. No, she didn't. In the area that I lived all my life, and even in this area, there's one company that provides all of the electricity and gas. There's technically three. But those other two have limited range. A lot of these public utility companies, yes, they have, quote, monopolies because they're public utilities. They're not meant to be elsewhere. And if you think that private companies couldn't come in You're just mistaken. The reason private companies don't come in is because their rates would be too high. People wouldn't use them. Because of the whole profit thing. I'm flabbergasted, as they might say. The EPA could not shut down or strip the license from the U.S. Navy for violation, says Teodoro. Who is this guy? They can't shut down the city of Baltimore. See what I was telling you? They probably went into one of the poorest areas of Baltimore, measured it up, and was like, oh yeah, this is horrible. And they probably did it like at the time of the day when they know that some emission is going to come out from some private company and it contaminates it, and they ran back and said, yeah, look at how bad this is. I don't know how these people run. Anyway, they can't shut down the city of Baltimore or the Tennessee Valley Authority, but they can easily shut down a private business if they fail to comply with regulation. When was the last time the federal government shut down a private utilities company for not complying with regulations? Even I think Enron bankrupted itself before the federal government stepped in. So what are they talking about? Wait, when was this? When was this? This was 2015, but when was it actually published? Do they have a date? July 17th. So this is around the time when, I mean, it wasn't huge news, but Flint was starting to make the social media rounds. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Continuing. Again, Teodoro and Kerensky. Oh, Kaninsky, I'm sorry, I keep saying Kerensky. Kaninsky tracked the EPA rates of enforcement of CAAs and SDWA regulators on public and private utilities. They found that the EPA was less likely to take formal enforcement action against public water utilities than they were against utilities owned by private firms. I say that makes a lot of sense. Because private firms, you know, contrary to what they're acting like here, private firms skirt a lot of things. And not only do they skirt a lot of things, but the EPA lets them do it. So if the EPA actually has to come down on you, it's probably because you're doing some craziness that you need to be in trouble for. Continuing. Still, privatization isn't necessarily the answer. Although Teodoro and Kaninsky found private utilities outperform public ones on regulatory compliance, they're also sensitive to their many shortcomings. What do you mean sensitive to their many shortcomings? Oh my God in heaven, what is wrong with these people? They're also sensitive to their many... No. That has nothing to do with being sensitive. No. It literally is just being fair and correct. They also note that there's many there's a big downside to having private utilities. What? My brain, y'all. Continuing, quote, we're really hoping this paper doesn't cause people to say, privatize, says Kaninsky, because that is a potential solution to these violations, but not the only solution. This was probably written. I bet you this was written by some, this was underwritten, should I say, by some entity that wants to push privatization of public utilities. I bet you that is what this was. Because to come out and say, we're really hoping this paper doesn't cause people to say privatize. Because that is a potential solution to these violations. No, it's not. And what's so funny is, so again, July 15th, 2015, Flint is 6 months away from hitting national media. Okay? Flint makes a mockery of all this. Continuing. Indeed, because private utilities prioritize their investors rather than their customers, their citizens, or these citizens. I mean, seriously, for God's sake, if this was 60 years ago, this would read like this. Indeed, because private utilities prioritize their investors rather than citizens. This is, to conservatives who are listening, do you understand these people don't look at you as citizens? You're consumers, you're customers. You have no rights. And you keep arguing differently. Anyway, continuing. Indeed, because private utilities prioritize their investors rather than their customers, they have little incentive to create, for example, tiered rate structures that are crucial for low-income households. Oh, they're so worried about that. And by the way, you don't need tiers. You don't need tier structures. You need to charge what is fair. Because basically, what she's amounting, what she's basically advocating there is, you need tier structures so you can determine how much you can gouge people by. Because that's what the tiers are. So if I'm just using these numbers, so if it costs you in a month's time, let's say it costs you $80 to light and heat a house. What she's saying is, in this area, if it costs you $80 to light and heat the house, I mean, no inflation of costs, no addition of profit, no nothing. It just costs you $80 with personnel and everything. You got like 300,000 houses. $80. Your goal is then to add some profit. Maybe you want 20%. Maybe you want 30. Maybe you want 100. Let's take 50% profit. So we're going to add $40. So now it's 120. What she's saying is, depending on where in the area the house is located, you may, instead of charging $80 to cover your costs, which is what a public utility company would do, they would also add upkeep, maybe 30% on top, so that'll be an additional $24. So you're paying $104. What she's saying is, if you live in a poor area, maybe you only pay 30%. So you're still at the 104. But if you're in a richer area, maybe you pay double. That's what she's talking about when she says tiered structure. So instead of you paying cost plus upkeep, you're paying cost plus upkeep plus we can charge you this because we can. We can gouge you because we can. And she's advocating that. Again, this is 2015. If y'all don't think that these people are planning this crap, man, you better wake up. Continuing, quote, low-income pricing schemes and rebate schemes and retrofitting, those are not going to be something the investor engages in unless they have that in their contract with the municipality, says Teodoro, which is exactly why this is all public utility stuff. Because a public utility is dedicated to maintaining the health and well-being of the public. Continuing, public utilities do another thing that private utilities have little incentive to do, conserve. To use the example of water again, Americans per capita daily water use has plummeted in the last several decades, largely a triumph of conservation efforts by public utilities. Man, oh, let me just continue. In what other business do people say, please, buy less of our product, says Teodoro. No private utility would ever do that. I swear. It's like, it's right there. Continuing. Still, here it comes. Utility infrastructure, particularly for water, is crumbling around the nation, and public utilities are having a lot of trouble getting up to code. Now, why is that? It's because rich people and corporations do not want to pay their god darn taxes. That's it. That's it. Joe Biden. So I'm recording this Good Friday, on Good Friday. Joe Biden has been talking about the once-in-a-generation investment in infrastructure. The United States needs about 20 times what the United States federal government just invested. And a lot of that crap went to tax cuts for big business and private companies. The reason the infrastructure is crumbling is because we haven't put the money into it. Yet, we have been putting tons and tons of billions and trillions of dollars into subsidizing big business so they can keep up their stuff. And then now big business finances papers that say public utilities suck because they're not upkeeping their infrastructure. But private industry is doing great because they're upkeeping their infrastructure. Oh, why? Because they're getting subsidies from state, local, and federal government to do so. Subsidies that should be going to the public utilities. The hypocrisy with this ish. Continuing. Still, utility infrastructure, particularly for water. Actually, I think I have to... Yes, okay. Still, utility infrastructure, particularly for water, is crumbling around the nation, and public utilities are having a lot of trouble getting up to code. I just talked about that. There are some basic solutions. Create subsidies for local governments so that they can get up to capacity without raising rates, which the United States... The government literally used to just... These people... My brain just glitched. these people stopped them from doing... This was part of the block grant freaking model. Oh, my Jesus. No. What is wrong with these folks? Oh, and then they write... See, the reason they can write stuff like this is because most people don't know about this, so I get it. But come on. Continuing. There are some basic solutions. Create subsidies for local governments so that they can get up to capacity without raising rates. Ramp up enforcement from federal regulators. Now, isn't that something? Bloomberg, the hater of regulation, put in ramp up enforcement from federal regulators. See, they're okay Guys, you need to pay attention to that, because they're okay unleashing the government on things that you depend on. They're okay with unleashing the government on you. But don't let the government come after them for doing wrong, because then they're a victim. This is psychopathic behavior. Continuing, or turn to private companies. After all the things that they talked to, this is me. After all the things that they talked about private companies not doing because they don't have the public interest center in their minds, they want private companies. After we saw what private companies did to Iraq, they want private companies to come through and control public utilities for the public when they don't even have in the back of their minds what is good for the public? Continuing, and this is actually about to wrap this up. But as for the last option, in this increasingly dry, overheating, and economically divided world, there are just too many drawbacks. Yeah, meaning what? At the end of this Bloomberg article. She has to acknowledge there are just too many drawbacks. But as for the last option, that's government looking to privatize companies, there are just too many drawbacks. She is even saying, don't do it. Now, mind you, the actual title of this article is The Privatization of Public Utilities Has One Major Upside. You notice the upside basically was they can charge whatever the heck they want. They can gouge you, which is what many of them do. And then they can use those gouging profits to supposedly keep their stuff up to code, which just ain't what they're into. The reason I wanted to read you this article, well, there's many reasons, but one of the primary reasons why I wanted to read you this article is because, look, I really don't believe that people understand. We are at the forefront of a major, major revolution in how we have to live on this planet. This major revolution is not going to transform just the federal government. It's going to transform the community, the society, the community and the... I went backwards. With the community, the society, the networks within the communities within the communities, and all the rest. I know that seems a little bit like, huh? But trust me. At the local level, the municipal governance structure is going to have to change drastically. This is something that none of you really think about, but there is actual, I literally discovered a series of books on municipal structuring and law and all the rest. And it's quite fascinating because it traces the concept of the municipal structure all the way back to the Roman Republic. And it's, again, quite fascinating. Restructuring how municipalities work is going to benefit the people living within them. All of you typically live in a municipality. Typically. There's a few exceptions. That is going to have to be restructured completely. The orientation of taxes to comfortable living, restructured. I wanted to give you a snapshot because I'm going to most likely read one more article and publish it with this one on public utilities. But I wanted to give you a snapshot of public utility versus private utility. Question, comments, concerns, you know, you can always reach out to me. I love hearing from y'all. I am your brother, Vimeer Diesel Guy, and make sure you please support the work that I'm doing. CWB Podcast, CWB Podcast. Hit me up on PayPal. Hit me up on Cash App. You know, do your thing. I am working on getting a P.O. Box. So if you want to send me a check, you can send me a check. Again, I'm your brother, Vimeer Diesel Guy. Love all y'all. Peace. There's a shadow on the faces of the men who sent the guns to the wars that are fought in places where their business interest runs. On the radio, talk shows, and the TV, you hear one thing again and again: how the USA stands for freedom, and we come to the aid of a friend. But who are the ones that we call our friends? These governments killing their own, or the people who find they can't take anymore, and they pick up a gun or a brick or a stone. And there are lies in the balance. Thank you for listening to Class War Battlefield Podcast, episode 2023.AR.01, published on May 28th, 2024. The references contained in today's episode include the following. Clip 1 at the 1 minute 55 second mark, originally published on October 10th, 2022 by the Jacobin YouTube channel. Privatization is War on Our Freedom with Donald Cohen. This clip has additional start times of 22 minutes and 14 seconds and 45 minutes and 16 seconds. Clip 2 at the 10 minute 11 second mark, originally published on November 24th, 2022 by the Australia Institute YouTube channel. Why Privatization Fails, Richard Dennis explains. Clip 3 at the 12 minute 5 second mark, originally published on December 12, 2018 by the Robert Reich YouTube channel, The Truth About Privatization, Robert Reich. Clip 4 at the 16 minute 34 second mark, originally published on May 31st, 2015 by the Chomsky Philosophy YouTube channel, Noam Chomsky on Privatization. Clip 5 at the 33 minute 28 second mark, originally published on September 23rd, 2022 by the Kano YouTube channel, Public-Private Partnerships Simplified PPP, 7 Reasons Why Government Privatized Services, The Truth. Clip 6 at the 38 minute 49 second mark, originally published on June 27th, 2019 by the Adam Smith Institute YouTube channel, Matthew Lesh explains the benefits of privatization. And clip 7 at the 55 minute 12 second mark, originally published on May 25th, 2016 by the New Economic Thinking YouTube channel, How Neoliberalism Threatens Democracy. There are multiple items included in the further research section, so please make sure you check those out. You can find a complete listing of these resources with links included by going to my WordPress blog, Class War Battlefield Podcast. Thank you again for listening, and I'll see you on the next one.